Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, September the 16th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jill Whitman. Her subject, Glaciation in the Cascades. Let's listen in.
Today I'm going to talk about glaciation, and I don't know if any of you heard the talk that Don Ring did a couple days ago about glaciation, but there's a little bit of overlap between the kinds of things that he talked about and the kinds of things that I talked about. I'm ultimately going to sort of move my way through the discussion to talking about some of the features that we see here in the Cascades and their origin. But I'm going to start out by talking about glaciers in general and a little bit about how they work and some of what we know about the history of glaciers. So, starting here with a picture of the Emmons Glacier from...
Looks like
someone's going up.
Well, glaciers do look like each other. But this is the Emmons Glacier over on the east side near Sunrise on Mount Rainier. Just to start you off with a picture. 2% of the Earth's water is found in our polar regions and is ice. It covers about a tenth of the land surface, and that is one type of glacier, which I'll talk about, sort of a continental glacier. We also have glaciers like these, which are called valley glaciers, and I'll be talking about them. They have sculpted very dramatically what we see around here. Glaciers are a system of moving ice, and I have a diagram here that is sort of a textbook diagram, but it helps us to discuss a little of it. What we have is a region in which we have permanent year-round ice, and that ice is in motion due to gravity. And we'll see as we look at the other type of glacier, the continental glacier, that gravity may be more of a weight pushing down and forcing it to move out, whereas here in a valley glacier, as we see in the cutaway, it's the pull of the force of gravity down slope. We have different parts of a glacier, so that have the head of a glacier, which is the region in which we have the significant accumulation of ice. We may have ice and snowfall that covers the entire glacier at certain seasons, but in the overall annual cycle, we have a part of the glacier that we call the ablation area, or the part of the glacier that is actually losing ice as water as it melts during the annual cycle. So we add snow up here, turns into ice, and we take it away down here. But the glacier is always in motion, so we're always feeding this lower part of the glacier as it moves down slope. Two other terms that we use when we talk about glaciers, we also talk about receding glaciers or advancing glaciers. And what we're talking about there is where the position of the toe moves through time. And if we have a time in which we're adding more snow and ice to the glacier system through snowfall than we're taking away through melting, then what will happen is we'll have an advancing glacier where the toe moves down slope. That's independent of the fact that the glacier is simply a system of moving ice. It's sort of this balance. If we're adding more than we're taking away, then the glacier grows in its length. In contrast, we may have a receding glacier because we'll have a season or two in which we have less accumulation of snow and ice, and melting which continues, and so the toe will move back up valley. Nonetheless, we still have a glacier which is flowing down and feeding that toe of the glacier. It's just that the balance between what we add and what we take away is such that we are taking more away than we add. The fact that it's a constantly moving body of ice is very important when we look at some of the features produced, particularly the depositional features that come from glaciers. Glaciers tend to move quite slowly, perhaps on the order of a few millimeters a day. There are some glaciers which experience dramatic surges. The cause of that is not particularly well understood. Because of the weight of the glacier, we tend to have sort of a layer of water where we actually have the ice melting because of the pressure, and that lubricates the glacier. And it's believed that perhaps some of these glaciers that undergo surges are having some excessive amount of melting of the water underneath to lubricate it. One of the glaciers that's near Juneau, Alaska, called the Variegated Glacier, about every 17 to 20 years experiences a dramatic surge, and the last one occurred in the early 1980s, where it moved about 55 meters per day. Can be tracked by, you know, looking at features on the ice or going out and putting stakes in the ice and measuring it and so on. If we think about a glacier, it will tend to move fastest down the middle and be slowed down along the edges, so that if you were to put stakes across a glacier at one time and come back later on, you'd see that those in the middle had moved further than those on the edge because of the friction and drag along the edge. This is a diagram to sort of show us what it would look like in terrain if we had a lot of valley glaciers. We'll come back and look in a little bit at what that region would look like if we melted out all of the ice. But what we have here are basically a system of rivers that merge, little tributary rivers that flow into the bigger system. It's just that that system isn't water, but it's ice, which is in motion instead. In the modern day, and even in our past episodes of glaciation, we find our valley glaciers at high elevations, places where we can have snowfall, which will accumulate and permanently year-round. They tend to find their paths down pre-existing valleys formed by streams, using that as their path to move on down. And we have a number of such glaciers in the United States. This is a picture of a glacier in Alaska. We can see many of these tributaries coming in and merging with the main glacier here. The brown material we see on the surface is debris which has come from the surrounding mountainsides and fallen down on the ice and being carried along on the top of the ice. The Alpine region is heavily glaciated, both in the past and still some in the present. And in fact, many times valley glacier systems are called alpine glaciers because that was where they were first studied. The Himalayan region is another area in which there are a significant number of valley glaciers. In contrast, if we look at a continental glacier system, what we have instead of a system that forms at high elevations is a system that forms at high latitudes. So in the modern day, we see an extensive continental glacier which covers all of the continent of Antarctica. We have Greenland, unlike its name implies, nearly completely covered by a continental ice cap. And if we go back, and I'll talk in a moment about some of the historical glaciation, if we go back a couple of million years, much of the northern hemisphere continents were covered by ice as well. Now these are not ice sheets that move under the influence of gravity as a downslope motion, because what we're doing is moving from high latitudes down to lower latitudes. This isn't because we get more ice accumulating at the higher latitudes, thicker ice sheet in the middle, it thins out toward the edges, and it's the weight of that ice sheet in the middle which forces it to flow outward. So instead of simply flowing down sort of as a linear feature, what we tend to have is something which is somewhat circular, and it flows out from the middle toward all of its edges. In Antarctica, the current ice sheet is believed to be about 3,000 meters thick. If Antarctica were to melt, it might result in a sea level rise on the order of about 60 meters. Now, I don't know where everyone lives, but you start thinking about some of the consequences of that. Since most of our commerce is centered in ports that are along the coastal regions, we suddenly find that our port cities all had to move. I lived in South Florida for a while in graduate school. I don't know if any of you spent much time in Florida, but south of Lake Okeechobee, which is sort of the big body of water in the middle of the state, the highest point above sea level is 23 feet. So we wouldn't have much of Florida left if we had significant melting of our ice sheets. There are some places where there are smaller, I'll talk about this for a sec. There are some places where there are slightly smaller ones. This is just showing a similar kind of a picture to illustrate some of the features that are left behind from a continental glacier. They tend to leave very subdued topography, but when they advance, and then they retreat, the same kinds of things, or receding glacier leaving their deposits behind, but again, flowing outward from a central point where it's thicker, thinning out toward the edges of that glacier where it melts. This is a picture in Chile. We're actually in high elevations, and you can see some valley glaciers in this region, but the entire part of the mountain range here is covered by a very small ice cap, where the ice is actually flowing out, not down valley systems, but simply out from the middle where it's thicker, out toward the edges. Well, what I want to do is spend some time talking about some of the features which we see that result from glaciers, so that we can sort of put that into the context for here. Glaciers produce two types of features. They produce features that come from their erosional processes. So as the glacier moves and they scrape and abrade the material, they produce certain features. And they also produce features that come from the depositional processes. Material which has been carried with the glacier and deposited and left behind produces a certain type of feature as well. If we back up to this diagram a sec here for the continental glaciers, what we find is these are massive, massive ice sheets which tend to move and subdue the terrain over which they flow, tending to erode the higher areas and deposit in the lower areas. And so we can go to areas that have experienced a dramatic amount of continental glaciation, and what we find is a fairly subdued topography. In contrast to that, when we look at some of the features from valley glaciers, they're very rugged and very dramatic features which are produced. This diagram gives us a very good illustration of some of the depositional features which are left by continental glaciers. They've tended to sort of smooth out the area, but where the glacier sits at some point and melts, the solid material, the rock material that's been transported with it, gets deposited. And we call those deposits moraines. If the glacier recedes over a period of warming, then the toe of that glacier will retreat, and we'll see this moraine left as a depositional body of material. Some of the other kinds of features that we see here are these little kettle lakes, where in the moraine material which has been deposited, blocks of ice have been left. When the ice melts, there's a depression which fills in with water, and so that's left behind. We also will sort of see some evidence of the path of movement of the glacier, some stream flow which may dissect the topography. Anyone who has heard much about glaciation realizes that we get a lot of lakes forming around these glaciers in the lower areas, and our Great Lakes are the result of the continental ice sheet cover during the major ice age. It retreated, it left a lower area which is filled in with water. You're from upstate New York or from New York. The Finger Lakes, if anybody's looked at western New York, it looks as if somebody took their fingers and just scraped down through the state. Those are also the result of continental glaciers, which as they moved over the terrain, there was some softer material and more rigid material, and the softer material was scraped out, just leaving that trace.
And the south shores of Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, have large moraines, very high. They're right up to about 1,000 feet in elevation above the surface of the lakes. And they were also
and that's moraine. What has held those lakes in, too, are those moraine deposits. Now I'm actually going to talk about that a little bit as I move on to talk about valley glaciers. But so if we think about continental glaciers, we think of fairly subdued topography. What little topography we see is often the result of the underlying bedrock, softer and harder material, and so on. On the other hand, if we advance to valley glaciers, this is a feature which can result from either continental or valley glaciation. These are features called striations. The ice moved parallel to these grooves that are found in the rock. The rock material that was being carried in the bottom of the ice mass just simply scraped the underlying rock. Very dramatic striations here. Has anybody here ever been to Devil's Post Pile, which is down near Mammoth, California? Well, Devil's Post Pile is basalt, which is cooled to form columns. but the top of it has been planed off by a glacier and has wonderful striations across the top of these six-sided basalt columns. So if you go, you have to appreciate not only the basalt columns, but the grooves that are on top. If we look at a valley glacier system after the ice has melted, we can see some of the very dramatic kinds of features that are produced. Valley glaciation or alpine glaciation produces very rugged topography and very dramatic kinds of features. The shape of a valley, which is produced by river erosion, tends to be V-shaped. I think of the Grand Canyon, that's kind of the perfect example of a river valley. The river erodes down, the erosion that takes place on the slopes is from the instability of rock as it sort of tumbles down. All of the erosion is taking place down in the bottom of the valley where the river is. In contrast to that, a glacial valley has a U shape to it. And that's because the ice not only has the ability to erode down at the bottom, but it erodes on the sides as it flows as well, leaving this very spectacular U shape to the valley, which is there. The main glacier was down here. We can see where there were tributary glaciers, and those two left behind U-shaped valleys. The tributary glaciers were smaller, the ice wasn't as thick, and so they didn't erode down as deeply. And so we have a valley that we call a hanging valley up above the main valley of the major glacier. That's also very different from a river system. River systems will erode down to what we call a base level, and so the rivers would erode down to the level of the river that they're joining. And so when we see river system valleys that join, they tend to join at the level of the river that they're flowing into, and so we don't have one valley high above another one. Some of the other features that we see are very sharp ridges, the remnants of the rock that's left in between. The name for those is French, it's arête. Comes from naming them in the alpine glacier area, where we have the head of a valley. It's a very bowl-shaped head, and the name is a cirque. And often these valleys will be fairly flat-bottomed, have fairly swampy drainage in them, and oftentimes have a lake, calling those tarns. We also can end up with some very pointed features, where a number of heads of various glaciers came together, leaving behind a single remnant at the head of that called a horn. Some pictures that illustrate some of these processes. These are a series of slides which have been put together to try and illustrate the origin of the Yosemite Valley area. Geologists believe that that region prior to glaciation had had a fair amount of river erosion, the topography was fairly subdued because the mountains were fairly old, and there were river valleys which later filled with ice. The ice not only eroded down, but eroded the sides, and when the ice retreated, a valley was left that had a U shape to it and very, very steep-sided walls with hanging valleys from the tributary glaciers. If we look at Yosemite today, we see that magnificent U-shape to it, and a perfect example here of a U-shaped tributary valley, so one of the hanging valleys in Bridal Veil Falls coming out of that. How many people have been to Yosemite? Not too many. Always used to think Yosemite was the best example of glaciated areas. Beautiful U-shaped valleys. A close-up of Yosemite Falls, and looking at this also as one that comes out of a hanging valley and flows down to the main valley floor. This is a picture taken up in the Northern Cascades of the head of a glacier. We can see sort of this bowl-shaped head, or the cirque, here at the head of a glacier, and the very, very rugged and sharp ridges around that. And a view of the Alps, looking down at heavily glaciated terrain and seeing these horns, these peaks that are left as glaciers flow down around them. Of course, the most famous of all horns is the... Okay, so a number of erosional features. We also end up with depositional features as well. And as I said, if we look at a system like this, we remember that it's carrying rock material with it on the surface and along the bottom. Where that rock material melts, we have moraines. We also end up, and that becomes called a terminal moraine, being at the end of the glacier. There are also moraines, deposits along the sides of the glacier called lateral moraines. And if we think of two glaciers merging together, they each had a lateral moraine on the side of them. Where they merge together, we then end up with what becomes called a medial moraine. And if you think back to the view we had much earlier of a glacier from Alaska, we saw all these different stripes on the surface, and that enables us to sort of figure out how many tributaries merge together. You don't have that ability when we look at a water system, because it all becomes mixed together. This is a view which comes from a lake called Convict Lake, which is on the east side of the Sierra Mountains, not too far south from Mammoth. And this is a lake which, actually, I probably would show a different picture having now hiked up to Holden Lake, but is a little tarn, a lake at the head of a glacial valley, and it's trapped by the moraine at the lip of the valley. So this water is held in by that moraine, that deposit of material which flowed down the valley this way. So I'm actually up on a ridge looking down into the valley, but we see those same kinds of things around here. That's what Heart Lake is. It's a lake behind a moraine. That's what Holden Lake is. It's a lake behind a moraine here as well. But again, you see this beautiful U-shape to the valley here. I want to talk just a little bit about sort of historical glaciation. When we look at how geologic features have been explained throughout history, back about two centuries ago, all the kinds of things which were observed geologically were explained by great catastrophes, particularly the Great Flood. And, I mean, obviously that fit with biblical interpretations. And then geologists came to realize that when they actually went out and observed various kinds of features in the record, that there were other things that had obviously accumulated very slowly, not instantaneously with a catastrophe, but very slowly. And if you've been to the Grand Canyon or down in the Colorado Plateau area, you see layer after layer after layer of rock. And geologists changed their views quite dramatically in the early part of the 19th century away from this catastrophism view to looking at something that was called uniformitarianism, very slow. That we could we realized that there was sort of no vestige of a beginning. It had begun very slowly and sort of no prospect of an end. It was going to continue slowly, addition by addition. And so that required geologists to sort of back off from any ideas of great catastrophes. And really that was a very important change in sort of the science of geology, to realize that we could look at present day processes, we could look at the bottom of a lake and see sediments accumulating very slowly and say that must have happened in the past millions of years ago, and that's how we explain this rock record. Well, that was fine until about 100 years ago, when one geologist in particular started wandering around in the Alps and saying, I can't explain these great big boulders by this very slow uniform process of accumulation. They're huge boulders. They don't resemble any of the rocks anywhere nearby. They had to have come here through some great catastrophe. That was Louis Agassiz. He spent a lot of time in the Alps studying these sort of erratic deposits, these boulders that had no connection to anything nearby. And then he came to North America and continued his studies and realized that the same kinds of features were seen here. And he was really the beginning of the wave of geology changing from realizing that everything wasn't a dramatic catastrophe, nor was everything all slow and ongoing and uniform, but there were both kinds of processes going on. And as a result of sort of his beginnings of these studies and geologists beginning to study globally, they came to realize that all of the Northern Hemisphere was covered by ice. starting somewhere between 5 and 2 million years ago. That's sort of great debate now as to when it all began. This is kind of an interesting view of the world. It's not one that we, in our day-to-day life, usually have. Geologists like to use all kinds of different projections of the Earth, but what we're doing is looking down here on the North Pole, and so this enables us to see the extent of glaciation, which occurred during the time period that geologists call the Pleistocene, the last few million years. And we can see, from our perspective, basically all of Canada was covered by ice, and various lobes of these glaciers came down into the northern part of the United States. Similarly, if we look over in Europe and Asia, we see that most of Northern Europe and most of the Siberian region was covered by ice as well. Now, that's kind of the term, the description that so many of us heard, is that there was this ice age and all of this was covered by ice. But in fact, as geologists have studied this more and more, they've come to realize that during these last few million years, that this glaciation has undergone advances and retreats. And that if we were to go back prior to 5 million years ago, there was no ice whatsoever in the Northern Hemisphere. So that was a very dramatic change from no ice at all in the Northern Hemisphere to ice cover. But if we think today, we do have ice in the Northern Hemisphere. So in one sense, we're still within this ice age. We're just in a time in which the ice has retreated from its most dramatic amount of cover to simply being sort of up over Greenland and some of the very, very, very high latitude areas. So within this ice age of the last few million years, we've had what we call glacial periods, where the ice has advanced down to lower latitudes, and interglacial periods, where the ice has retreated to just covering those coldest areas of all. So that means today we live in this ice age, but we live in an interglacial period, a time where the ice has retreated very dramatically. The evidence from the rock record and from the sediments that are observed is that these glacial advances happen on cycles of about every 100,000 years. The last retreat was about 10,000 years ago, so we're probably safe that we're not going to have another one of these advances and come down and cover most of the northern part of North America again. But we are living within an ice age, and it's a very different global view of the Earth than if we go back 5 million years ago when there was no ice cover in the northern hemisphere. Similarly, we could go back about 20 million years ago and there was no ice cover on Antarctica either. So this idea of sea level being 60 meters higher was probably true about 20 million years ago. The ice cover began in Antarctica earlier. A lot of studies have been done to try and figure out what would make that change happen so dramatically. Why would it cool so much in Antarctica to accumulate ice cover? And similarly, the same question has been asked about the Northern Hemisphere. What change occurred about 5 million years ago to produce ice accumulation in the Northern Hemisphere? And geologists believe that much of this has to do with the movement of the plates and the movement of the continental masses and their effects on the circulation of the oceans of the world. The isolation of Antarctica away from other continents appeared to have started about 20 million years ago. It's the only place in the world where we have a current that flows all the way around the Earth. And that has made a very cold and isolated continent for Antarctica, allowing the accumulation of ice that then doesn't melt. Most of the current theories to explain the onset of Northern Hemisphere glaciation attribute it to the closing of the isthmus between North America and South America. And that then reduced the warming in the Northern Hemisphere. There used to be flow in the tropical region between the Pacific and the Atlantic. And that allowed the northern parts of the oceans to cool. That doesn't help us, however, to explain these cycles of why every 100,000 years the ice advances and then it retreats. The theory which is believed at this time to explain that has to do with our orbital parameters for the Earth. And the cycles that the Earth goes through in terms of the shape of it, which is elliptical, and how much the Earth is tilting and wobbling away from the Sun. And when geologists sort of fine-tune all of those parameters, they discover that it would put the Earth on a cycle of about every 100 million years in terms of being cooled by being just that much further away from the Sun and tipped that much further away from the Sun and so on. Becomes quite technical, but it's one of these ideas which is still being explored in terms of its explanations. Before we get into talking specifically about the Cascade region and glaciation, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the effects of this kind of glaciation. Referred to some of that in that we can see the ice came down and left major deposits here, moraines that have been identified to see the final extent of the ice cover. The island of Long Island from New York is a terminal moraine from the ice lobes over here. Cape Cod is one of the recessional moraines. Number of moraines throughout the Midwest as we look in this region. One of the other things we see is that much of North America had a lot of very large lakes associated with it. If we think of the whole northern region as being much colder, one of the things we have to do is sort of compress our climatic belts. And so what we think of as the temperate region being very wet, that we think up in latitudes up here today, was moved southward as the ice cover advanced and the temperate regions were here. And so this was actually a region that experienced much more rainfall. We can still see evidence of those lakes if we go out into the dry areas. If you've ever been to the Great Salt Lake, that is the remnant of one of those very, very large lakes. You can look up on the hillsides around the Great Salt Lake and see the previous beaches from the higher lake levels when that lake was larger. Don Ring, when he spoke earlier in the week, talked about Lake Missoula, which formed out here at the melting edge of the ice, another one of these very, very large lakes that formed. He also talked about the Scablands, an area that was eroded very dramatically in eastern Washington as the ice dam that held in one of these lakes burst. And tremendous volumes of water rushed out and eroded down through the rock. Some of the other kind of neat features that we can see as evidence to tell us that we had this much ice cover is to go to areas which were depressed under the weight of the ice and see evidence of those rebounding as that weight has been removed since that time. You can go and look around Hudson Bay and see, again, uplifted shorelines as that region has responded to the removal of the weight of the ice. And similarly, there's a fair amount of small earthquake activity that takes place in Scandinavia. And again, that's another area that has rebounded very gradually from the weight of the ice. Yeah.
Looking at the Arctic Ocean there on the left side, is there any reason why there is no ice cap along that that left side, where, you know, you got the ocean that comes right up to the landfall, but there's no.
It's a good question.
Ice cap.
Why no ice over here?
Yes.
Well, part of the problem is that, of course, that's not land area today. So it's more difficult to know the extent of the ice over the oceanic regions. We have a lot of evidence to suggest that there were regions that were exposed as land, which today are below sea level. Because of course, if we take and put a whole lot more water in our ice up on land, we're going to lower sea level. And so this is, you know, this is this land bridge connection between Asia and North America, which is believed to have been the path for the migration of so many different animals, including humans. But I've studied a lot more about glacial geology here in North America, and less about here. One answer I'm going to give you is that I'm not sure that we have as much data, so I wouldn't trust as much the boundaries of the ice cover here. Because this is land area, we can practically walk out the limits of ice cover there. Certainly, we would think that the ice cover would have been more dramatic in that region as well. Although it is interesting to notice that while the ice cover sort of came down across the northern Atlantic, it did not come as far south as the limits of the ice on land, and in part that's because of the thermal properties of the ocean, that it actually is harder to cool down. And so that this region, which today is flooded with water, it simply may not have cooled as dramatically either. It's a good question, though. And I don't know 100% the answer for that. Okay, I'm going to not deal with this theory of orbital parameters, but to instead move on and talk a little bit about the effects of glaciation here in the Northwest. If we look at the state of Washington, this is a map that shows us the limits of the ice cover in the state of Washington. You can see that it came down in this obviously pre-existing low area, which we now think of as the Puget Lowlands. A lobe came down somewhere down south of Olympia, not as far south, sort of having an uneven limit as we move across the state. The evidence for that is here today in the state. If one goes into look at the Puget Lowland, the kind of material that we see at the surface is very typical of glacial deposits, fairly poorly sorted, loose sedimentary material ranging from sort of large blocks down to very fine material, sort of all jumbled together. And we tend to associate that with glacial deposits. If we also look in the mountainous areas, we can see that they were more extensively glaciated as well, not just in the lowlands, but to look, for example, around Mount Rainier, we can see the lobe of ice that filled in the Puget Lowland, the limits of that here. And what this map is showing us is the present-day limits of glaciers that we find on Mount Rainier in the dark black, and then these gray stippled areas are the areas that were covered by glaciers during one of the glacial episodes, where not only did we have an advance southward of the continental ice sheets, but the high elevation glaciation was more extensive as well. So again, coming down and filling the river valleys, the lowlands that existed. So this was a continental ice sheet, and these were simply more extensive valley glaciers.
I would assume Mount Rainier was taller at that time, too.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Yeah, although Mount Rainier's history is a very complicated one because it was growing from volcanic activity simultaneously with the glacial episodes. Mm-hmm. And so that it was fighting, in some ways, a losing battle of constantly trying to grow but being eroded, which is the fate of all mountains. Mount Rainier lost probably about 2,000 feet in elevation, though, when its top blew off about 6,000 years ago, which was sort of independent.
It's also building a new dome.
It is building a new dome, although it hasn't done too much of that recently. So this is a view down looking with a map view then of Mount Rainier presently and looking at the glaciers that are associated with the mountain today. Washington State has more glaciers than all of the other lower 48 states put together. Alaska is the only state with more glaciers than the state of Washington. We have glaciers basically in two areas within the state of Washington, a number of them on the Olympic Peninsula, and then a number of them associated with the Cascade volcanoes. This is Mount Rainier's 26 glaciers that emanate out as valley glaciers from the summit of the mountain. And I started out by showing you a picture of the Emmons Glacier, which flows off in this direction. This is a view of the mountain from just below Paradise, and you can see a number of glaciers here. This is a close-up view of the Nisqually Glacier as it comes down toward Paradise. You can see this surface of the ice. It almost feels like it's in motion. It's solid material, but it's flowing down and over slopes, and so the surface of it has been broken up and cracked as it flows and moves down the slopes. The toe of the glacier, at the time this picture was taken, was down almost here. If we look at a more recent picture taken, the toe has receded up to right here, and all of this is moraine material which has been deposited by the glacier. Needless to say, the summit of the mountain wasn't in view.
Yeah. Are there evidences of catastrophic flooding when the volcano heated up? I mean, in Iceland, they have these jökulsá and these tremendous outwash plains because their glaciers are on top of volcanoes. Is there evidence of some really catastrophic things, of the massive melting of the glaciers?
Well, mudflows, which have been associated with the eruption of the volcano. When the volcano erupts, even if all it does is release a bunch of steam and a little bit of ash, that heat can cause those glaciers to melt. And they will then pick up all of this material sort of within them and which has been deposited at the foot of them and travel great distances as mud flows. And the Puget Lowlands has many, many such deposits which are attributed to phases of mud flows coming from Mount Rainier, not necessarily associated with dramatic eruptions like that of Mount St. Helens, but with episodes of melting of the ice from heating. Picture that I didn't take, and the costumes sort of help us date a little bit perhaps when it was taken, but a picture looking down in one of these huge cracks or crevasses on the surface of one of the glaciers of Mount Rainier.
And then Mount Adams in the background?
I think so. And just a view more distant, looking over at sunrise across one of these alpine slopes to the Emmons Glacier as well. Again, another day when the summit wasn't in view. The surface here is so visible in the crack that you can almost feel the ice as it moves down. If we move into the North Cascades region, the Northern Cascades were established as a national park in 1968. And this is a region which is highly carved by valley glaciers. Very, very dramatic sculpting, leaving us with extremely rugged terrain in this area. They're often called, the North Cascades are often called the North American Alps because their terrain so resembles what's seen in the European Alps. An area in which there's obviously very high snowfall, as those who spent the winter here at Mount Old Village could attest to for this past year. And as a result, we have very dramatic sculpting. This is just a picture of one of the U-shaped valleys on the sunrise side of Mount Rainier, showing evidence of more extensive glaciation, the valley glaciers having carved out. This is a view of Glacier Peak. We can see the summit here of Glacier covered by all of these glaciers as they come out from a central point, leaving us sort of with this horn and these very sharp ridges as evidence of glaciation. I have to confess, these are not pictures that I took, but this is a picture again of Glacier Peak and this classic view of Image Lake.
Someday.
This is, anybody know what this is?
It ought to. Mary Green Glacier.
That's right, this is the glacier up above Holden Lake.
Right.
Mary Green. See, somebody remembered it. The other day, all we could think of was that it was Mary. That's right. But so we still today see evidence of this glaciation, some areas where ice still remains. The deposits up there around Holden Lake, of which I have no pictures because they're all in my camera, are evidence of having been deposited by glaciers. But as we look here at Railroad Creek Valley, we can see the U shape to the valley, both as we look downstream and as we look upstream. Now, we are actually in a hanging valley. The major glacier was the one that flowed down the valley of Lake Chelan. The biggest piece of evidence to tell us that Lake Chelan was eroded by a glacier is the depth of the lake valley. It's 400 feet below sea level, 400 plus feet below sea level. Rivers can't erode below sea level. They erode to the lowest level to which they flow, which is sea level. It takes ice and its great thickness and weight to be able to push down and erode down below sea level. And also, if you look at the sides of the Chelan Valley, I mean, it's very steep-sided and sort of a U-shaped bottom. To me, the classic example of a hanging valley, though, is Copper Basin, where we have the low Holden Railroad Creek Valley down here, and then this beautiful U-shaped Hanging Valley.
Almost the Hanging Valley itself. It almost looks like
it is a Hanging Valley. Yeah. So Copper Basin is a Hanging Valley where there was a smaller tributary glacier to the Railroad Creek Valley Glacier, and then there was a, it joined this glacier. And we know this is a Hanging Valley because in order to get from here down to Chelan, you have to go down very gently and then down very steeply down the hanging
on the right side of that, there is a hanging glacier now.
Up here?
Photo, yes.
Yeah, up around the side. Yeah. Still the remnants of an area that's covered by snow year-round. All right. Well, that ends my saga here. I'd love to answer people's questions.
Were the potholes then formed by the continental glacier, or were they formed by the breaking of Lake Missoula?
Which potholes?
Oh, sorry, potholes in eastern Washington.
Oh, they're part of the Lake Missoula outpouring.
Okay.
No, that's a good question, because we tend to have the Kettle Lakes left in areas where the ground is covered by the loose debris deposited by the glacier.
What do you mean by Kettle Lake?
Well, they're where we had a big ice block that was left in the sedimentary deposits, and then the ice block left and it left a depression. But that'll be in an area where there were moraine deposits of loose material. What we find in eastern Washington is that the rock was just scoured bare by the outflowing of Lake Missoula, and that the potholes there are the same kinds of features that we find in stream valleys today, where, you know, some rock gets picked up and eddied around and acts as a scouring on the rock beneath it. And so it erodes out a pothole, but the problem is in eastern Washington, we're not talking about a rock this big, having done that, but you know, something the size of this room.
What was the climate like around equator when the ice caps were biggest?
Well, that's a good question, and geologists believe that it was very similar to today's. Because the climate at the equator is controlled by our budget of solar radiation.
Uh-huh.
But what we had was an equatorial climate like we have today, and a high latitude climate like we have today, but they were simply closer together.
Uh-huh.
So the climate belts were compressed.
Uh-huh.
And so our belts that we think of as being the desert belts at about 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south will probably move slightly further south and narrower, and our temperate region today has moved south and compressed as well.
So the comfortable living areas were much, much more.
And further, yeah, and further south as well.
But the area called the Mound south of Olympia, is that found other parts of the earth? Is this due to glacial activity?
You know, I've never been to see the mounds. I've just heard lots of discussion about them. And I don't think there's any one explanation for them. I think there are some people who want to attribute them to human activity in the past, and others to glaciers. But no, there's nothing quite like it, which makes it hard to say it's due to glacial activity, because you'd expect to see it elsewhere as well. Very regular topography like that is a bit unusual for glaciers. Are there other questions?
Washington has so many different types of areas. Like we have rainforests and true deserts. And was all this caused by the glaciers and what was left?
Probably a better explanation for the differences in the climatic belts, particularly as we go from west to east, is the presence of a very high mountain range. That sort of does two different things. It separates eastern Washington from all the moist air that comes from the west, because those clouds and the weather patterns don't tend to make it over the high mountains. It also causes all the water to rain out there on the slopes. So, you know, we have such different rainfall on the west side of the Cascades from the east side of the Cascades. And I would attribute that more to sort of our physical geography that we have, rather than sort of the geologic history.
Isn't our physical geography from the
geologic history?
It is, but not just from the glaciers. Yes, right. From lots of geologic processes. That's right.
What canal here in Washington was supposedly carved by a glacier, you know, by the Continental Glacier?
Right.
I've always wondered why it has the dog leg at the bottom.
Oh, because it just deposited stuff, or there was harder rock that prevented it
because
from sort
it
of taking
came,
out the middle.
Because it comes south, and then it actually goes back to the northeast again.
Yeah, right. And you know, that peninsula area in between just contained more rigid material that wasn't eroded, but once it, or harder material, but once it flowed over that, it was able to erode a little bit down there at the bottom. That's the dog leg. Yeah, the Hood Canal is simply part of that whole fjord that was carved
right.
out to make the Puget Sound area.
Right.
And then deposits since then have sort of filled in and altered some of that carving. Other questions? Well, thank you for all coming in from a beautiful morning to sit indoors.
Thank you.